Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And today's narration is the seventh one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And it deals with Constantine, King and Emperor. At that time, Cole, Duke of Kalcolim, that is to say Colchester, started a rebellion against King Asclepiodatus. He killed the king in a pitched battle, and took for himself the distinction of the royal crown. When this was made known to them, the Senate rejoiced at the death of a king who had caused trouble to the power of Rome in all that he did. Mindful as they were of the setback which they had suffered when they had lost the kingdom, they sent as legate the senator Constantius, a wise and courageous man who had forced Spain to submit to Roman domination, and who had laboured more than anyone else to increase the power of the state of Rome. When Cole, king of the Britons, heard of the coming of Constantius, he was afraid to meet him in battle, for the Romans' reputation was such that no king could resist him. The moment Constantius landed in the island, Cole sent his envoys to him to sue for peace and to promise submission, on the understanding that he should retain the kingship of Britain and contribute nothing more to Roman sovereignty than the customary tribute. Constantius agreed to this proposal when it reached him. Cole gave him hostages, and the two signed a treaty of peace. Just 1 month later, Cole developed a most serious illness, which killed him within 8 days. After Cole's death, Constantius himself seized the royal crown and married Cole's daughter. Her name was Helen, and her beauty was greater than that of any other young woman in the kingdom. For that matter, no more lovelier girl could be discovered anywhere. Her father had no other child to inherit the throne, and he had therefore done all in his power to give Helen the kind of training which would enable her to rule the country more efficiently after his death. After her marriage with Constantius, she had by him a son called Constantine. 11 years passed, and then Constantius himself died at York, and bequeathed his kingdom to his son. Some few years after his elevation to the throne, Constantine began to give evidence of remarkable courage, for he was as fierce as a lion. He maintained justice among his people, moderated the rapacity of footpads, put an end to the oppressive behaviour of local tyrants, and did his utmost to foster peace everywhere. At that time, there lived in Rome a certain dictator called Maxentius. His ambition was to disinherit all the nobles and all the most distinguished citizens, and he crushed the state of Rome under the grossest possible tyranny. Those who were driven into exile by his oppressive savagery fled to Constantine in Britain and were received honourably by him. Once a great number of such men had found their way in flight to Constantine, they at last managed to fill him with hatred for the tyrant whom I just mentioned. This by ceaselessly complaining to him in speeches like the following one. "How long, Constantine, do you propose to endure this disaster which has forced us into exile? Why do you delay our return to our native land? You are the only one of our race who is powerful enough to expel Maxentius and to give us back what we have lost. What prince can ever be compared with the King of Britain, either for the might of his lusty soldiers or for his treasures of gold and silver? We beg you to march on Rome with your army, taking us with you, and so give us back our possessions, and restore our wives and children to us." By these happenings and other similar events, Constantine was encouraged to go to Rome. He captured the city, and then was made overlord of the whole world. He had taken with him three of Helen's uncles, Ioclinus, Traherne, and Marius. He arranged for these three to be elected into the rank of the senators. Meanwhile, Octavius, Duke of the Gavesi, led a revolt against a certain proconsul in whose hands, as a Roman dignitary, the government of the island had been left. The proconsul was killed, and others with him, and Octavius seized the royal throne. This event was announced to Constantine, and he sent Helen's uncle Traherne with 3 legions to restore the island to Roman sovereignty. Traherne landed on the coast near to a town called Carperis in the Welsh language. He attacked the town and captured it within 2 days. This news spread through all the tribes, and King Octavius thereupon conscripted an armed force from the whole island. He marched to meet Traherne, not far from Winchester, in a field called Masuria, in the Welsh language, and there he began the battle and won the victory. Traherne withdrew to his ships with his wounded troops, went on board, and sailed away to Albany, the various regions of which he began to ravage. This was duly announced to King Octavius. He reassembled his men in companies, followed Traherne, and fought him in the province called Westmoreland. This time Octavius was defeated and fled. When Traherne realized that the victory was his, he pursued Octavius and gave him no respite until he had wrested from him his cities and his crown. Octavius was greatly saddened by the loss of his kingdom. He sailed off to Norway to seek help from King Gunbert. As an interim measure, he ordered his close friends to do their utmost to assassinate Traherne. The leading figure of a certain municipality, a man who cared more for Octavius than any of the others, obeyed his commands as soon as he possibly could. One day, when Traherne was on his travels, some way away from the city of London, this man lay in ambush with 100 of his own soldiers in a certain valley in the forest, through which the king would have to pass. He attacked Traherne unexpectedly as he passed by, and killed him in the midst of his soldiers. When Octavius heard this news, he returned to Britain, scattered the Roman forces, and drove them in flight, thus regaining the royal throne. In a short time he showed such personal bravery, and acquired such a vast store of gold and silver, that he feared no man. Indeed, he held the kingship of Britain, in great content from that moment onwards, until the days of Gracianus and Valentinianus. Years later, weakened now by old age, Octavius decided to make provision for his people. He inquired of his counsellors which of his family they proposed to raise to the kingship after his death. All he had was a single daughter, for he lacked a son to whom he might bequeath the government of the country. There were some among his counsellors who advised that he should give his daughter in marriage, and with her the kingship, to a man chosen from among the Roman nobility. This so that they might, with the greater confidence, expect to enjoy peace. Others, however, advised that Conanus Meridiadocus, the nephew of Octavius, should be declared heir to the throne of the kingdom, and that the king's daughter should be married off to some prince from another country, with a dowry of gold and silver. While these things were being argued out between them, Caradocus, the Duke of Cornwall, arrived and gave it as his opinion that they should invite the senator Maximianus and offer him the hand of the princess together with the kingship, and so enjoy peace forever. Maximianus was a Briton on his father's side, for he was a son of Iolinus, the uncle of Constantine, whom we just mentioned. From his mother and by race he was, however, a Roman, and by birth of royal blood on both sides. This solution, therefore, promised a lasting peace. Caradocus felt that Maximianus had a right to Britain, for he came both from the family of the emperors and from a British origin. Conanus, the king's nephew, was annoyed by the advice which the leader of the Cornishmen had given. He strove with all his might and main to seize the kingship, and in trying to achieve his objective, he upset the entire court. Caradocus was unwilling to retreat from the position which he had taken up. He sent his son Mauritius to Rome to explain things to Maximianus. This Mauritius was handsome in stature and of great personal courage and boldness. If any criticism was ever offered of things which he had decided, he used to support his decisions by force of arms in single combat. When he appeared in the presence of Maximianus, Mauritius was properly received and honoured above the warriors who accompanied him. At that time, there existed a great rivalry between Maximianus himself and the two emperors, Gracianus and his brother Valentinianus. For Maximianus had been denied the third share in the empire which he wanted. When Mauritius saw that Maximianus was being badly treated by the emperors, he gave him the following advice. "Why, Maximianus, are you afraid of Gracianus, when a way lies open to you by which you could snatch the empire from him? Come with me to the island of Britain, and you shall wear the crown of that kingdom. King Octavius is worn out with old age and debility, and seeks nothing better than to find someone to whom he may bequeath his kingdom and his daughter. He has no male heir, and he has asked the advice of his leaders about whom he shall marry his daughter to, and to whom he shall give his kingdom. His warriors have answered his appeal, and he has decided that the girl and the kingship should be offered to you. They have sent me to you, so that I may tell you of this. If you will come with me, then you will be able to carry out this project from its early stages onwards. With the treasure house of gold and silver which exists in Britain, and the horde of warlike soldiers which lives there, you will be strong enough to return to Rome, drive out the emperors, and capture the city. This is what your relative Constantine did, and many other kings of ours who have risen to be emperors have done the same." Maximianus agreed to what Mauritius had said. He came to Britain, sacking the cities of the Franks on the way, and thus collecting together a fortune in gold and silver, and rallying soldiers to his banner from all directions. Soon afterwards, he put to sea with a following wind and landed at Southampton. When this was announced to King Octavius, he was completely petrified with fear, for he thought that an enemy army had arrived. He called his nephew Conanus to him, and ordered him to summon all the armed soldiery of the island, and to march out to meet the enemy. Conanus immediately assembled all the young men of the realm, and came to Southampton, where Maximianus had pitched his tents. When he saw the vast company of men arriving, Maximianus was overwhelmed with anxiety, and did not know what to do. He himself was accompanied by fewer troops, and both the numbers and the boldness of the men who had come terrified him, for he could not hope to pacify them. He summoned his older advisers, with Mauritius himself, and then began to inquire what he should do in the circumstance. "It is not for us," answered Mauritius, "to fight with these lusty warriors. We have not come here with the purpose of conquering Britain by force of arms. We must ask for peace, and for permission to camp here, until we know what the king intends. Let us say that we have been sent by the emperors to bring a message from them to Octavius, and so humour these folk with friendly words." This plan pleased everyone. Maximianus took with him 12 of his leaders, white-haired men who were wiser than the others. As he went forward to meet Conanus, they held olive branches in their right hands. When the Britons saw these men of venerable years who bore the olive as a sign of peace, they stood up respectfully to meet them, and made way so that the envoys could approach the British general more freely. Soon, the visitors stood in the presence of Conanus Meridiodocus. They saluted him in the name of the emperors and the senate, and announced that Maximianus had been sent to King Octavius to deliver dispatches from Gracianus and Valentinianus. "Why, then, does so strong a force accompany him?" asked Conanus in reply. "This is not the usual habit of legates. It seems more like an army on the attack, which thinks to do us injury." It was not considered proper for so important a man to come here ignominiously without an armed escort, replied Mauritius, especially in view of the fact that Maximianus may well be hated by many kings because of the majesty of Rome and the deeds of his own forefathers. Had he come with a smaller escort, he might, perhaps, have been killed by those who dislike the state of Rome. He comes in peace, and it is peace that he seeks. This can well be believed from his behaviour. From the moment that we landed, we have acted in such a way that we have done wrong to no man. We have paid for what we have received, like peaceful folk, and when buying necessaries, we have taken nothing from any man by force. While Conanus was hesitating as to whether he should opt for peace or war, Caradocus, Duke of Cornwall, arrived. With him came a number of other leaders who, once they had listened to this petition, persuaded Conanus not to attack. Conanus would have preferred to make a battle of it. Nevertheless, he disarmed and granted the visitors peace. He conducted Maximianus to the king in London and explained the whole circumstance, point by point. Then, Caradocus, Duke of Cornwall, ordered the bystanders to withdraw. Taking his son Mauritius on one side with him, he addressed the king as follows. "See how God has brought about, in the way which suits you, the very thing which has long been wanted by those who have managed to keep, by their true affection for you, the trust you placed in them. You ordered your leaders to advise you what you should do about your daughter and your kingdom, now that your senile condition makes it difficult for you to go on ruling your people any longer. Some recommended that you should hand over your crown to your nephew Conanus and marry your daughter off in a seemly way in some other land. These were they who would have faced the ruin of their countrymen if a prince speaking some foreign tongue were set in authority over them. Others would have offered the realm to your daughter and to some nobleman of our own speech who could have succeeded you after your death. The majority, however, advised that someone of the race of the emperors should be sent for, someone to whom your daughter could be given, and the crown with her. These men assured you that a firm and abiding peace would then follow, for the might of Rome would protect them. God has now deigned to bring to your shores this young man, born, it is true, from Roman stock, yet sprung too from the blood royal of the Britons. If you take my advice, you will not hesitate to marry your daughter to him. Suppose you were to deny him this, what legal argument could you bring against him in the realm of Britain? He is of the blood of Constantine. He is a nephew of our own King Cole, whose daughter Helen possessed this kingdom by hereditary right, as none can deny. When Caradocus had made his points, Octavius agreed with him. With the consent of all, he gave the kingship of Britain to Maximianus, and his own daughter with it. When Conanus Meridiadocus saw this, he was more angry than you would have thought possible. He went off to Albany and busied himself in raising an army, so that he could molest Maximianus. Once he had collected a force together, he crossed the Humber and ravaged the lands on both sides of that river. As soon as this was announced to Maximianus, he assembled his entire force and hurried to meet Conanus. He fought with him and left the field victorious. However, Conanus was not so reduced that he could not begin destroying the countryside once more, as soon as he had reorganized his troops. Maximianus returned to the fray. They fought again, and the king withdrew only after he had been beaten. Finally, when each had done the other as much harm as he knew how, they made peace with each other, with the blessing of their friends. 5 years passed. Maximianus developed an obsession with power because of the enormous amount of gold and silver that flowed into him daily. He prepared a fleet and conscripted every armed soldier in Britain. The kingship of Britain was not enough for him. He wanted to subjugate the Gauls too. He crossed the Channel and went first to the kingdom of the Armorici, which is now called Brittany. He began to attack the Frankish race which lived there. The Franks came to meet him under their leader, Himboldus. They fought against him, but finding themselves in sore straits, they turned in flight. Duke Himboldus himself had fallen, with 15,000 armed men who had gathered from the entire kingdom. Maximianus was delighted at the fact that he had slaughtered so many men, for he knew that after such immense casualties, the country could easily be taken. He summoned Conanus to him, some way away from his troops, and said to him, with a quiet smile, "Well, we have seized one of the fairest kingdoms of Gaul. We have every reason to hope that we shall capture the rest. We must occupy their towns and strong points as quickly as we can, before the news of their danger penetrates into the Gallic hinterland and calls to arms the entire nation. If only we can hold this kingdom, then I have no doubt that we can subjugate the whole of Gaul. You must not let it depress you that you have permitted the kingship of the island of Britain to pass into my hands when you had hopes of possessing it yourself. Whatever you have lost in Britain, I will make good to you in this country. I will raise you to the kingship of this realm. This will be a second Britain, and once we have killed off the natives, we will people it with our own race. The land produces heavy crops of corn, and the rivers are full of fish. The forests are attractive, and the pastures most pleasant. Indeed, in my opinion, no country is more agreeable." Conanus bowed his head and thanked Maximianus, promising that, as long as he lived, he would be faithful in doing homage. Without more ado, they drew up their lines of battle and marched to Rheims, taking it that same day. The savagery of the Britons was already well known, as was the number of men they had killed. The townsfolk fled at full speed, leaving behind their wives and children. Everyone else in the cities and castles followed their example, so that the Britons marched in without meeting resistance. Wherever they came, they massacred the men, sparing only the women. Finally, when they had wiped out every single male in the whole land, they garrisoned the cities and castles with British soldiers and fortified the high hills. The inhumanity of Maximianus became common knowledge throughout the other territories of the Gauls. Great terror took hold of the leaders and princes, for they seemed to have no hope, except in offering up prayers. From every country district they fled to the cities and castles, and indeed to any places which seemed to offer them safety. When he realized what a source of terror he was, Maximianus became even bolder. He hurried to increase the size of his army by offering lavish bribes. He enlisted the help of all who wished to steal the possessions of others, doing all that he could to buy them off with gold and silver and any other gifts that he could think of. As a result, Maximianus assembled what he considered to be a force large enough to enable him to conquer the whole of Gaul. At the same time, he put off acting in his own peculiar savage way until the kingdom which he had captured should settle down, and he should be able to restock it with people from Britain. With this end in view, he issued an edict that 100,000 ordinary men and women should be collected together in the island of Britain and should come out to him, and with them 30,000 soldiers who might protect from any enemy attack those who were to remain in the country. As soon as he had achieved all this, he distributed these people among all the tribes of the Armorican kingdom. In this way, he created a second Britain, which he gave to Conanus Meridiodocus. He himself went off to the remoter parts of Gaul with the rest of his soldiers. He conquered that country, and the whole of Germany too, after a number of desperate battles, gaining the victory in every fight. He set up the capital of his empire at Treves. Then he vented his fury upon the two emperors, Gracchianus and Valentinianus, killing the one and driving the second out of Rome. Meanwhile, the Gauls and the Aquitanians were causing great distress to Conanus and his Armorican Britons. They harassed the newcomers by attacking them time and time again. Conanus resisted these attacks, returning bloodshed for bloodshed, and defending with great manliness the country committed to his charge. Once he had gained the victory, he decided to find wives for his troops, so that heirs might be born from them, who should hold the land forever. To prevent any mixture of blood with the Gauls, he ordered women to come from the island of Britain and to be married to his men. With this end in view, he sent messages to Britain to Dionotus, Duke of Cornwall, who had succeeded his brother Caradocus in the kingship of Britain, telling him to take personal charge of the business. Dionotus was a king of great nobility and power. It was to him that Maximianus had entrusted the rule of the island, while he himself was occupied with the affairs described above. He had a daughter of extraordinary beauty, whom Conanus had always wanted for his own. When he saw the messenger come from Conanus, Dionotus agreed to meet his wishes. He therefore assembled from the various provinces 11,000 daughters of noblemen, with 60,000 others born to the lower orders, and commanded them all to come together in the city of London. In addition, he ordered ships to be brought there from the different coasts, in which they could cross the sea to the husbands, who I just mentioned. This pleased many in the great crowd, but it displeased an even greater number, who loved their parents and their homeland with deeper affection. Moreover, there were some present who preferred chastity to marriage and would rather have forfeited their lives among no matter what people than have become rich in this way. Indeed, they all had their personal wishes in the matter, if only they had been able to achieve what they really wanted. However, the fleet was made ready, the women went on board the ships, and they put out to sea down the River Thames. On the last part of the journey, just as they were turning their sails towards the men of Armorica, contrary winds sprang up against the fleet, and this scattered the whole company in a very short time. The ships ran the hazard of the seas, and for the most part they foundered. Those which escaped this terrible danger were driven ashore on islands inhabited by barbarians. The women were either slaughtered by the uncivilized islanders or were sold into slavery. They had fallen in with the execrable army of Wainius and Melga, who, on the order of Gracianus, were killing off those who lived on this coast and in Germany. Wainianus was king of the Huns, and Melga king of the Picts. Gracianus had made an alliance with them, and had dispatched them to Germany to spread havoc among all who favoured Maximianus. As they raged along the seacoast, they met the young women about whom I have told you, who had been driven ashore there. When the men saw how beautiful the girls were, their first intention was to have intercourse with them. When the women refused to permit this, the Ambrones attacked them and slaughtered most of them there and then. As soon as Wainius and Melga, the leaders of the abominable Picts and Huns, who favoured the cause of Gracianus and Valentinianus, learned that the island of Britain was denuded of all its armed soldiery, they hurried off in that direction as fast as they could go. First, they made a treaty with the neighbouring islands, and then they landed in Albany. They drew up their line of march, and then invaded the kingdom, which had no one to rule or defend it. They cut the unthinking country folk to pieces, for, as I just stated, Maximianus had taken with him all the young warriors whom he could find, leaving behind the unarmed and witless peasantry. Once the leaders whom I have named discovered that these folk had no way at all of resisting, they slaughtered them wholesale, continuing to ravage the cities and provinces as though they had been so many sheepfolds. When this great calamity was announced to Maximianus, he sent a freedman, also called Gracianus, with two legions to bring them help. As soon as these men came to the island, they fought with the above-mentioned enemy, killed off a great number of them, and drove them off to Ireland. In the meantime, Maximianus was killed in Rome by friends of Gracianus, and the Britons whom he had taken with him were either slain or scattered. Those who managed to escape fled to their fellow countrymen in Armorica, which was already called the Second Britain. When the freedman Gracianus heard of the death of Maximianus, he seized hold of the royal crown of Britain and made himself king, Then he began to exercise such tyranny over the people that the plebs banded together to attack him, and eventually they assassinated him. As soon as the death of Gracchianus became common knowledge throughout the other kingdoms, the enemies I have spoken of returned from Ireland and brought with them the Scots, Norwegians, and Danes. These people ravaged the kingdom with sword and fire from seacoast to seacoast. As a result of this most cruel oppression and devastation, messengers were sent to carry letters to Rome. They begged, with tears and supplication, that an armed force should come to avenge them, and they promised perpetual subjection, if only their enemies could be driven far away. A legion, which had played no part in the earlier disaster, was immediately put under their command. Once this legion had been shipped across the ocean to the country, it met the enemy in hand-to-hand conflict. The Romans eventually slew a great number of the enemy and drove all who remained out of the territory. As soon as the legion had freed the prostrate people from this fearful maltreatment, the population was ordered to construct a wall from one sea to the other, to divide Albany from Dera. This wall was erected by a great crowd of workmen as a deterrent which should hold off their enemies, and as a real protection for the inhabitants of the country. Albany had been completely devastated by the barbarians who had landed there, for when hostile people came, they looked upon that country as a convenient lurking place. The local inhabitants therefore pressed on with the work and finished their wall, using private funds and public ones which they had collected. The Romans then announced to the country of Britain that they could no longer be troubled with such wearisome expeditions, and that they considered it an insult to Rome that a large army of this type should be importuned on land and sea for the sake of a cowardly pack of vagabond freebooters. The Britons ought, instead, to develop the habit of relying upon their own armed power, and they should themselves defend their country, their property, their wives, and their children, and, what is greater than these, their own liberty and their very lives. This by fighting manfully with all their strength. In order to give themselves an opportunity of delivering this warning in full public, the Romans ordered all men of military age in the island to assemble in London, for they themselves were making ready to return to Rome. When everyone had come together, Guithelinus, the Archbishop of London, was ordered to speak. He made the following speech to them. "When, at the command of the princes who stand around me, I am forced to address you, I feel more like bursting into tears than embarking upon a lofty discourse. I am greatly saddened by the state of deprivation and abjectness which has overtaken you since Maximianus stripped this kingdom of all its army and all its young men. You were simply the last remnants left, common people, ignorant of the ways of war, men who were busied in other matters, some in cultivating their fields, for example, others in the various makeshifts of business life. When hostile men of other nations came to attack you, they forced you to abandon your sheepfolds, just as if you yourselves had been sheep wandering about without a shepherd. Then the might of Rome restored you to your possessions. Surely you will not always put your trust in being protected by someone else. Won't you accustom your hands to brandish shields, swords, and spears against those who would be no mightier than you yourselves, if only you could throw off your laziness and your lethargy? The Romans are tired of all this perpetual travelling about, which they have to do, in order to fight your enemies for you. They now elect to forego all the tribute which you pay, rather than be harassed any longer in this way, on sea and land. Given that you were only ordinary folk in the days when you possessed soldiers, do you think that for this reason you have lost all claim to manhood? Surely men can be born out of their social caste. A soldier from a farmer, for example, or a farmer from a soldier, Surely a military man can be the son of a shopkeeper, or, for that matter, a shopkeeper the son of a military man. Given the possibility of one caste being born from another, I find it hard to believe that people are such that they can actually lose their manhood. If you are men, then behave like men. Pray to Christ to give you courage, and then protect your own liberty. When he stopped speaking, the crowd applauded him so loudly that you would have said that there and then they were inspired with courage. Next, the Romans gave the pusillanimous Britons some firm advice. They left behind them models showing how weapons could be constructed, and they recommended that towers should be built, overlooking the water at intervals along the seacoast of the southern shore, where the Britons kept their shipping, for it was there that barbarian attacks were most to be feared. However, it is easier for a kite to be made to act like a sparrowhawk than for a wise man to be fashioned at short notice from a peasant. He who offers any depth of wisdom to such a person is acting as though he were throwing a pearl among swine. The moment the Romans said goodbye and went away, apparently never to return, the enemies whom I have mentioned reappeared once more from the ships in which they had sailed off to Ireland. They brought with them other companies of Scots and Picts, with Norwegians, Danes, and all the rest whom they had under command, and seized the whole of Albany up to the wall. Once the departure of those who had supported the Britons became known, and the fact that they had sworn never to return, the invaders pressed on even more confidently than before with their devastation of the island. In opposition to them, slow-witted peasants were posted on the top of the walls, men useless in battle, who were unable even to run away for the very palpitation of their bellies, and who shook with fear through the days and nights on top of their stupid perches. Meanwhile, the enemy continued to ply their hooked weapons, dragging the miserable plebs down from the walls with them, so that they were dashed to the ground. The very suddenness of the death they endured was a stroke of luck to those who were killed in this way, for by their immediate execution they avoided the miserable torments which awaited their brothers and their children. Oh, how God avenges himself for past sins! Alas, for the absence of so many warlike soldiers through the madness of Maximianus! If only they had been there in this great disaster. No people could have attacked them whom they would not have driven away in flight. This was made clear enough as long as they remained there. In those days they occupied Britain in all tranquillity, and what is more, they added far distant realms to their own power. Thus it is when a kingdom is handed over to the safe keeping of its peasantry. What more can I say? Cities were abandoned, and the high wall too, for the inhabitants, banishments, dispersions, which were even more desperate than usual, pursuits by the enemy, and more bloody slaughters followed fast upon each other. Just as sheep are torn apart by the wolves, so were the wretched plebs maltreated by their enemies. Once more, the miserable remnants sent letters to Agicius, the general commanding the Roman forces, to convey the following appeal. To Agicius, three times consul, come the groans of the Britons. There followed a short introduction, and then they continued their complaints as follows. The sea drives us into the hands of the barbarians, and the barbarians drive us into the sea. Between the two of them, we have two deaths to choose from. We can either be drowned or have our throats cut. For all this, the messengers returned sadly home, to explain to their fellow citizens their lack of success, for they had received no promise of help.
Listen to Radio Aryan. RadioArian.com.